Welcome back to another episode of Better Than I Found It, the podcast all things college golf. This is Mike McGraw, the men's golf coach at Baylor University. My guest today on Better Than I Found It is Albert Jennings, a current assistant golf professional at Brookwood Golf Club in Fort Wayne, Indiana, also the director of a junior golf academy with about 80 junior golfers. Albert was once a golf prodigy and was actually one of the first players I ever hosted for an unofficial visit as the head golf coach at Oklahoma State. In this interview, Albert and I discuss his journey, which has had its incredible highs and actually, of course, its inevitable lows. What's really refreshing about this interview is Albert's unyielding positive perspective and his very genuine attitude of thankfulness and gratitude. You'll also see what effect great parenting can have on a junior golfer's career. Albert is a breath of fresh air in a world of win-at-all-cost mentality. Enjoy. Okay, Better Than I Found It listeners, I've got a really special guest today. Actually, a good friend of mine and an acquaintance of mine since his junior golf days from Fort Wayne, Indiana, Albert Jennings. Albert, welcome to the podcast today.
Coach, thanks so much for having me. I'm super happy to do it.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I have a memory of your, before we get too deep into this, you obviously, your title today is Assistant Golf Professional at Brookwood Country Club in Fort Wayne, Indiana. You wear a lot of hats, I know, and you teach a lot of golf. You teach a bunch of people how to play the game, and you are promoting the game in a big way. But when I met you, you were just a very young, I don't know how old you were, but you were a very old kid who took an unofficial visit to Oklahoma State University. And let's talk about that as we get into it, and we'll just take it through where your career has gone. That what year was that? 2006?
That would have been 2006 because yeah. Jonathan Mora just won the national championship individually. Mm-hmm. And I believe you all won.
Yeah, we did
also. And I believe it was that summer because I would have been finishing eighth grade and going into ninth grade.
Well, of course, the rules have changed. An eighth grader can't come on campus with the coaches anymore. It has to be August 1 of your junior year. But in those days, they could come as early as they wanted to onto campus and as many times as they wanted. So it was like, wow, I mean, this kid from Indiana, I didn't know much about you, but you had called me or emailed me or whatever and arranged the official visit, which was great. I remember the day quite well. What are your memories of it?
So the convoluted way of kind of how we got there was that my dad had put together, this ages me, he had put together a DVD of my highlights, and he sent it to a bunch of the major club manufacturers. And Alan Bratton was at Ping at the time before he joined you. And he brought me out to Ping. And, you know, we started that relationship, which I'm just still super grateful for to this day. But then soon after that, he left to go to Oklahoma State. And then that was how we got connected. And I had had some success kind of from age 11 to 14 in that range. And I had won the Little People's National Championship then in 06, I believe also. And then came and saw you guys. And so I remember being super excited, you know, as an eighth grader to go across the country to the best program in the country with, you know, the best player in the country, at least, you know, from the national championship. And so we got there and the rules were that you couldn't watch me hit. You couldn't watch me do anything golf-wise. So you guys were on the way out to take my parents on the campus. And Jonathan Mora and I were on the first tee and you guys turned around. We both hit our shots and you said, "Hey, good luck. We'll see you later." And that's something I'll never forget, and how, you know, special I felt, and, you know, how I felt probably even a little competitive with Jonathan. So I'm like, all right, I gotta show I can play a little bit, you know.
Did you beat Jonathan that day? Or do you remember?
I don't think so. To my memory, I thought I shot 75 and wasn't even close. But it's been a long time.
You know, Jonathan is really one of the great stories in the history of college golf that not a lot of people talk about or know about, but he came into college as one of the best junior players in the country, got injured, kind of
labored through a really, really tough freshman year about a year before you would have met him. And then came back and was 34 under par the last three tournaments. He won he won the last three tournaments he played in that year, including the national championship by three. And then 4 months later, you're playing golf with him. But for him to have come from where he was that freshman year in Stillwater when he had to redshirt to being the NCAA individual champion, off the charts. It was crazy. And easily one of the nicest guys that was a good player that I've ever met in my life.
Right.
Was he kind to you that day, I imagine?
Yes, he was. And I think, you know, that's one thing I feel, super blessed about and feel fortunate that a lot of the people that I did come in contact with, whether it were players, coaches, folks from club manufacturers, they were all, you know, great people and super invested. And I think that most are super invested in the junior game and helping kids that have talent be able to, you know, grow it and continue to get better. And Jonathan certainly, you know, was in that category. I think I tagged him in a post maybe a year ago or so. I came across that old picture and I sent it over to him. But yeah, he was awesome that day.
Well, I'm glad to hear it, but certainly not surprised. One of the things that always struck me about you, so you took the unofficial visit, you go through the recruiting process. We didn't end up getting you. You go to Ball State, pardon me. But all through that process, and since I've continued to correspond with you by text message off and on occasionally through the years, there's one quality you have that I think is essential to being great at anything, and that is gratitude. And I've always felt like you were really thankful for things that were being done for you, things that people went out of their way, sacrifices that were made. And I contend that's good parenting. So let's talk about your parents real quick, because I mean, I don't know how a kid just, he doesn't come out of the womb and say, well, I'm grateful for everything. He's taught those things. So how did you get your gratitude from your parents?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the both of my parents, you know, emphasis growing up was on joy and gratitude, and regardless of what else was going on, you still were to keep this attitude of being blessed and being happy and joyful to be here and have the opportunities that you do have. And that was, I give my parents a lot of credit for instilling that in us in a way that when we were having success, that was key. But then for me, especially in that, basically all through high school, struggled and had a lot of failure. And, you know, if the attitude is woe is me, or, you know, I can't believe this, or it's because of something somebody else did to put me in this position, then it's a really quick way to be miserable. So, you know, I remember even as I struggled to have a lot of gratitude for how well I had done, the position that I'm in, still having every day an opportunity to go out and keep trying. And that was just something that they instilled in us and they were consistent about, so that for me, whether things are going well or not going well, we can still have that gratitude and thankfulness. And I think the way that it can really manifest for me and I think for a lot of people is every day you can come with a new energy, because you're not just continually sinking into, oh, it's not going well for me, and this is why, and da 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 da. So I think that every day for me is a new opportunity to re-engage with that gratitude and show how thankful I am by, you know, trying my best on any given day.
Well said. And it's kind of corny, but it's something I've said through the years with my golf team is I wake up 4 under par every day.
Yeah.
So now I don't finish 4 under par every day,
right,
trust
right.
me. But some days are tough. But if you wake up the feeling like you're already under par, like I've got a great life, this is wonderful. Most of that comes from my faith that is very important to me, that it's like, you know, I know that I'm tested at times and whatever, but gratitude is one of the greatest qualities and one of the most attractive qualities on human beings, period. And you notice it and you know it when you see it. That's why I've always known it about you. We really don't know each other that well. We met each other in that unofficial visit a little bit more during recruiting, and then and just connecting through the years, but it's easy to see you're very thankful for all that's been done for you. I guarantee your players feel that.
Well, I appreciate that, and I hope that they do. I think it reminds me of something that I've said to players before, and it may have been in the book Zen Golf. It might have been in Every Shot Counts, but is this idea for a player that wherever the ball goes, that's where it was meant to go, and it couldn't have gone anywhere else. And the sooner that you embrace that while you're playing, especially in competition, the better off you're going to be. So I think for me, and with how well I did up till about age 14, that put me in a position to meet you. But then how much that I struggled from 14 to 18, that was how it went, and that's just about the only way it could have gone. And I have to have a lot of gratitude about that right now, because I'm still tempted. Justin Thomas, who's from Kentucky, that's somebody who I played with a bunch. Adam Shank, we competed with each other all the time and every summer. And I root for those guys on tour so hard. But there are definitely times where I feel like, man, like I was on that trajectory at a time. But how it happened for me and where my ball went, that was the only place it could have gone. So I'm gonna go find it. And ironically, when I was struggling, it was mainly off the tee, and I got really good at getting out of certain positions and making the most of it. And I still get really excited when I get to work on those types of shot with players, because it's like, hey, this is what it's about. It's not always going to go the way that you intended on the first tee or on any tee box, but there's still time to work it out, and it just takes one good shot. So I feel like with my career and my relationship with golf, even though it took a turn, people ask me all the time if I still play, if I still compete, and I really don't very much, because I'm all in on this, and that's where my passion is, especially when it comes to juniors and playing competitively, is being by their side. And so I'm super grateful that it went how it did, because that's the only way it could have gone.
Boy, what a good perspective that is. And honestly, you have an academy. You're not only an assistant golf professional where you work in the shop, but you also have an academy where you work with probably around 80 junior golfers, probably 40 of them tournament players. So you have to be able to impart your experience and interweave it throughout their, I would think, their journey. So how do you use your experience to make you a better coach? Because you are a coach for those players.
I think when I first started, I shied away from using my experience. I think a part of that was because I hadn't fully kind of worked through how I felt about it. And then partly because I think I wanted the kids to kind of have their own experience and me not influence too much. I mean, maybe that's a weird thing for a coach to say, but I try not to influence or push them in too much of a direction, especially dealing with, teenagers. So, if they would ask, I would talk lightly about my experience. And with the kids specifically, it's mainly about trying to honestly communicate what it takes to meet whatever their goal is. I think, anytime I heard a really good definition of burnout, where it's not always just I'm working really hard and I got tired. It's usually some miscommunication or misalignment between the goals and the time and investment that's being put into it. And in the junior golf case, that's the kid, that's the family, including the siblings, that's the parents. And so when that's misaligned a little bit, it's easy to get into kind of a bad place where somebody's upset or stressed or more anxious than they should be about this game. So I like to try to honestly communicate, like, hey, here's what it takes. Here are the sacrifices that I made, that our family decided to make to be able to have the opportunity to play at a higher level. And that's from as small as missing the kickball tournament, the championship in fifth grade, and missing a dance, or not being able to go to the lake with friends or whatever that is. Because I think that if the family has that information and the junior has that information, they can then make that decision. But if they don't, then sometimes you get to junior, senior year, and it's like, wait, I thought I was on a good track. So I try to honestly communicate that. And then lately, and in the last couple of years, I've been able to lean into talking more with the parents. I think also when I first started, I didn't want to talk to parents at all. I'm just like, you guys just leave us alone. I'm connected with the kid. We're good. And as I got older, I had to get over that. I had to get better at communicating with parents and try to help them navigate this, because their role, their job is really, really difficult. Kyle Morris, who's a great instructor in Columbus, Ohio, he said to me when I first was getting started that whether you like it or not, they're an assistant coach. Mm-hmm. And so them having good information and them knowing how to communicate with the kids, that's really important. Because, you know, one thing that I recognize is that my dad, he was doing his absolute best. And like I said, you know, he burning a DVD to send to the manufacturer, right? And he's going above and beyond driving and getting people to take me places. So these parents, and I tell them all the time, I always recognize that they're doing their best. It doesn't mean, just like their junior golfer, it doesn't mean that we can't improve and look for spots where, hey, you don't have to say that right now. You can ask this question, you can do this. And there were things that I can remember being 14 that I took from my dad as being a negative thing, but it really wasn't. One example that I think of often is that I would be on a tee box, and as I'm stepping into the ball, I would see dad usually take one or two steps left or right. And I would think as a kid that that's because I was aimed wrong. Now, years later, as a coach trying to get in some of those same positions,
yeah,
I realized that he was probably just not on the line he wanted to be able to see it well. Mm-hmm. Or he wanted to see where I was aimed so he could help and give me input later. But as a teenager with a teenage brain, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, he's checking my aim and now I'm probably off and now I'm overthinking it, right? And pushing blame over onto him. And so while I was valid in those feelings and he was valid in what he was doing, it was just a communication thing where I can say to parents now, hey, where you stand may feel small to you, but it's really important to the kid. And getting a routine and a flow to where when they play well, what are you doing? When they're not playing well, what are you doing?
Because that's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
Because you were really successful 11 to 14 with some great parents. And you weren't as successful from 14 to 18 going into college. It kind of gave you a different path in college. But to college. But my point is give parents some advice. I know nobody asking for it, but give them some advice as to how they could look the same in the 11 through 14 when you were a superstar, in the 14 through 18 when you were struggling. What are some things parents could do to make sure their kids feel validated regardless of the result?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it was Boyd Summerhays on your podcast that talked about not showing visible frustration. And that's such a simple thing. And I love listening to great instructors like that, because, you know, there are a lot of things that they say that are profound, but then there are also things that are just really simple. Mm-hmm. And so when, you know, we talk about when a kid breaks something on accident, a toddler knocks something off of a table, you know, a parent has this reaction to the glass and all these things, but what the kid is understanding is just, I'm in trouble. That was bad. They're stressed. They're upset. And then they start to internalize some of that. And that process continues as we get older. And as we're still tethered to our parents and we're very, I tell parents all the time, they've seen you when you were upset about the directions. They've seen you when you're running late. They know what it looks like when you're stressed. So when you start to show a little bit of that, they're going to pick up on it faster than anybody. And maybe even sooner than you realize. So, you know, I'm a big proponent of monitoring how far away you are from the kid, just literally the amount of yards. Some parents will get further away when the kid starts playing poorly. And sometimes the kid's asking for that.
Yeah.
But in an ideal situation, everything is just the same. The same thing we ask kids to do and say, hey, I should know if you're 3 over or 3 under. It's like, okay, well, parents, I should know if they're 3 over or 3 under from the way that you are. There's a great clip of Larry Bird when Reggie Miller hit that 3-pointer. There was still a little bit of time left for Michael Jordan to maybe do something. Reggie Miller's jumping up and down in circles and the camera goes to Larry Bird and he's just chewing his gum. And if you saw his face, you would think he was at the, you know, DMV. Mm-hmm. And I think about that image a lot because I'm just trying to, whatever I'm feeling inside, because I'm feeling a lot. And I, you know, I love these kids so much and I get nervous with them and I feel bad. But if my body language shows it, then they're gonna feel it too. So I hold myself to a standard that I, you know, ask the parents to try to do also, which is however you show up that day, keep it consistent, because you're not perfect. There are gonna be days where you're upset about something else. It could be work related, it could be family. But can you show up for them well that day? And if you can't, I think it's also okay to not go and just have that conversation and say, hey, you go play and do your thing and enjoy. And if you need me there, then that's a different conversation in and of itself. So I think more communication between the parent and the child about what the child wants to see from them out there, and then do your best on that. And on days that you can't, you can honestly have conversations with your kid about why you can't, or what you're going to do instead, or that, hey, I'll see you later and we'll have dinner, whether you shoot 75 or 95.
You know, I have one parent that I've coached his kid before, and he's pretty high energy. He looks stressed sometimes, and people misread him. His son doesn't. His son knows that's just my dad. That's the way he is every day. But I tested this once he got on campus. It was his fall of his freshman year, and we were playing a tournament. And unfortunately, he signed an incorrect scorecard and was disqualified. So we were in the scoring tent, and he was dealing with the emotion of having just cost the team some shots, himself a finish, all of that. And so I walk out of the scoring tent, and his dad came over to me and said, is something wrong? I said, yeah, he did. He signed an incorrect scorecard, so he's disqualified. And he looked at me, and I thought he was going to get really upset. And he goes, well, I'm glad that happened now. I bet he's going to learn a great lesson from this. And he said, he'll be fine. And he walked off and went to the airport. To me, that moment, that parent told me, okay, his result that the kid has is not going to affect how he handles it. Now, he wants the result to be good. He does hold his son accountable. But the fact is, he signed an incorrect scorecard. Oh, good. We have a learning opportunity here today. So that's hard to do. And I don't see it happen from that many parents.
Yeah, absolutely. There was that, I think that when it comes to our reactions and, you know, him saying, okay, good, you know, that's great. Like, I think it's important to realize that these kids have their whole lives ahead of them. And a big part of sport is to help teach them lessons, and they're going to make mistakes, and it's better that they make them in the midst of a game, something that's not going to cost them, you know, money or put a dent in their livelihood or anything like that. It's a game, and they're still learning how to be adults and be young men and young women. So I think it's important, and telling parents often, and I'm reminding myself often, to remember that they're, you know, teenagers, in this case, you know, college player, but they're still young and they have their lives ahead of them. And it's our job to help whatever's happening in their life, kind of help them comprehend it and understand what to do with it as time moves on, and how they can learn and grow from it.
Really good. That is such good advice for parents, that what you just said over the last 10 minutes. I'm going to capture this one. This is good. I love that. Because honestly, that's not just junior golf parents. It's also parents of collegiate players who I'm coaching. And so, and I love that what you just said, but I also have some other questions about you, because in that same process, a kid gets to college, he's away from home for the first time, and you remember what it felt like. He's going to make some mistakes. And that's when he finds out, like, what the preparation is that his parents had for him. What's your advice? What would you have loved to have known? One thing, if you had known it, your transition to college would have been better for you personally.
You know, I think I would have liked to know, and maybe a little bit before I went to college, but I would have liked to know that you're not as good as you think, and that's okay. And start from there, because my process in, you know, from 11 to 14, I was winning 80, 90% of the time. And then through that stretch, I got to believe, you know, the ego got big. Like, there's no way around saying that the ego was just big. And I even get protective now of students that are doing well, when it comes to, you know, newspaper or a news story, or because those were things that were just, especially for me, you know, being, you know, a young Black golfer, you know, I played my first tournament in 1997 when Tiger won the Masters. And so those comparisons, most of the news articles or stories, I'm in a red mock turtleneck, and, you know, that's kind of a part of the story. So I think there was a lot there for me that inflated my ego in a way that wasn't super healthy. One rule that I like to use now for all players, whether they're doing really well or struggling, is I'd like their average finish to be just above halfway through the field, kind of in that middle third. And on average, I'd love for them to have some wins. But if they're winning all the time, or if you're at the bottom of the field all the time, that's not a healthy set of data for you as you're kind of trying to figure out how good you are or not. And so I think for me, when I started to struggle, it was so jarring because I thought I was just so good and would continue to be really good forever, which is not the case. And I think what makes a good 8-year-old, what makes a good 14-year-old, what makes a good 20-year-old are all different things. And so understanding that to be good at the next level might take something slightly different in terms of how you go about it and what you focus on. And I think we have way more information now to help guide juniors on that, where I tell kids all the time, sometimes I get questions about, well, what would you go back and do differently or whatever? And at the time, we were really focused on the mental aspect of it. And we just felt like there was a mental block there. And a lot of families and juniors still find themselves asking that question when they're not getting the results that they want. I tend to go the other way and say, if Nelly Korda's nervous when she tees it up, if Rory's nervous when he tees it up, we're not going to make your child not be nervous and not quite play as well as they can every time they compete. But if their skills are really high and we really focus on developing the right skill set for the challenge, then even if they're nervous, they're still going to have good outcomes. And so for me, I would have wanted to hit it farther because I started hitting it short and crooked because I'm trying to hit it. And now I know that that's enough to sync results. If I have a player that's hitting it short and crooked, I'm going to say, hey, we got to fix one of these. And if the crooked's not going away, we need to hit it a bit farther right now. Mm-hmm. So I think I would have liked to know that, like, maybe around age 16, like, hey, you are good. You've done a good job up until this point. We need to take a fresh look at your game, where the holes are, what the potential issues could be. The national team in Sweden, they will remove skiers out of their age group if they've peaked. If they've won a bunch of tournaments in their age group, they take them out of competition, and then they help them train for that next level. And so I think that one of the things that I try to look for with kids as it relates to my experience is, how are they doing right now? And are they ready for the next challenge? When the boys go from, you know, 5,800 to 6,400, the scores are going to go up if we're not ready for the distance, if we're not ready to hit more 6 and 5 irons and things like that. So I think I would have liked to know, hey, the challenge will get harder. You're going to have to evolve with it. And it may not fully be a mental, emotional block. It may be that there are some skills you need to get a little bit better at.
Well, I think that's part of the deal. You still have to have humility as you go up in this journey. The humility says, I'm not as good as I need to be. So that's gonna make me work harder, change or look at things in a different point of view. Great advice. I wish I'd have known that too. Although I didn't have the inflated ego that you had. I didn't win as often as you did. But so you played college golf, and I know that you had some good finishes. I mean, you had some really nice finishes, but overall you'd say you probably didn't achieve what you thought you might in college. I didn't either. But what's your greatest memory from being on that college golf team? What's the biggest value you got from being at Ball State?
So it happened to be that, so I was recruited. I took a gap year. So I graduated in 2010. And we didn't have the offers that we wanted. And so we made that decision to take a gap year and keep playing in tournaments. And I was fortunate enough to win the first tournament that we put on the schedule in the fall. And I emailed Coach Fleck at Ball State, and he had me for a visit. And he had just had actually a good friend of mine turn him down on an offer, and there wound up being a spot for me. And so, again, really fortunate that that happened that way. And then that next year, he recruited a guy, my best friend now, James Blackwell from Buffalo, New York. And the two of us were on a team together, and at a time, and for a lot of our college career, we were the only Division I team that had two African-American guys on it. That was a, you know, non-HBCU. And so I happened to meet my absolute best friend and our life experiences were so similar, being, you know, young Black golfers that kind of came up at the same time. So similar. And both of us had early success. He wound up getting in a car accident that gave him an injury to where his trajectory kind of tailed off. And so at the end of my 5 years, his 4 years, Coach Fleck surprised us with taking us to the PGA Minority Championship. And it was just the three of us that went. And not only did the PGA do such an amazing job with that tournament, to get to finish my college career with my best friend, with Coach Fleck, who is, you know, now and still a close friend, and all the enjoyment that we got out of it. And it was one of the first times that we all were able just to, you know, be together on a trip. We were obviously competing, but it wasn't, you know, with the team, and it was just going out, playing golf, enjoying each other. And that's something I just will never forget. And I'm super grateful for Coach Fleck for making that happen, because he didn't have to. Primarily the teams that were there were kind of all HBCU teams. And then if you had a minority on your team, you could take them as an individual. And so the fact that he did that, and Corey Zadonis, who went on to be an assistant at IU for a little bit, he was a part of making that decision for us too. So that was certainly my best memory, but there's so many of them that involve both of those guys that I mentioned, you know, other teammates that I had. And that's the part that I try to help build into what I do now, is giving kids and juniors more community and more team and togetherness at an early stage. Because for a lot of kids, the first time they get that is in college, depending on how their high school team is or what their local junior golf scene is like. But a big part to me was the camaraderie with James and with Coach Fleck, but then, you know, also over the years, all my teammates that I had, and going through that experience together, taught me so much and was just such a good thing to be able to look back on. Yeah.
You know why I know that that's real is because you finished eighth. So you had a top 10 finish, but you didn't mention it.
Okay.
Your experience wasn't dependent upon having a good finish and playing well. You just love the experience that Coach Fleck gave you with your best friend on the team. That's amazing. And honestly, as we meander through this conversation, I didn't know what direction this thing was going to go. You've done an amazing job so far of helping guide me through it. Thank you. But you and I are coaches. You just at a different spot. You're at a country, you know, you're a golf course. Your junior golf director, academy, whatever, you teach a lot of kids, you're a coach. And all through my career, people will ask me, you know, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to win championships? Well, no. Yeah, I am, but nobody wins. So what I'm really trying to do is get guys ready for life. I'm trying to teach them life lessons. And I think that's what my dad did for me, was taught me life lessons. And he was my only instructor, only coach that I really ever had other than a team coach. So what life lessons are you really teaching kids right now? There's 80 of them you work with on a fairly consistent basis. What are you truly teaching them, Albert?
So, you know, to your point, the golf, the activity is the vessel. You know, it puts them in a position where they've got to work for something. They have to, you know, produce some consistency in their work ethic. And so I think there's a lot of things that are baked in because, you know, to your point about championships, it's like they're nice and we want them, but at the same time, that's not going to be for everybody. And so it can't be the full measuring stick. So regardless of the player, I do like to set a goal that's just a little bit of a reach. It's just outside of what you think you might be able to do. One of the things I'm really passionate about is being alongside a young person as they achieve something that they maybe didn't know was possible. And even if that's just a little bit outside of, and for some kids, that's playing in a tournament. For some kids, it's winning an AJGA event. But either way, that moment where they realize, you know, their chest gets a little bit bigger and it's like, no, I can do this, whatever that thing is. So I think that in a way, by saying, okay, improvement is important to us, you're putting them in a position where they're learning to strive and fail and deal with that failure. So, you know, I think as time has gone on, I've been really focused with how they deal with performance in general, because whether or not they're a high performer in golf, they're going to feel performance anxiety or pressure to perform in other areas of their life as they grow, whether it be in college for a big project, whether it be with a, you know, a partner down the road, in business. There's going to be a time where you have to perform. You've got to kind of put it on the line and give it your best. And so when we go through these exercises of pushing ourselves a little bit more than what we think, it's to prepare them for when they will inevitably have to do that in their lives. And I see a lot of kids do a really good job of making that decision and pushing themselves to a point that gives them that opportunity. And then on the flip side of that, and the relationship between these two things are important, is understanding how to rest and be a kid, because I think that both of those things are possible, to where you can say, okay, I'm going to organize my life to go after this thing and this activity, but I'm also going to be able to set it down and go be a kid, go have rest, get 8+ hours of sleep, and organize their life to where they can be able to perform at this thing that they, you know, maybe really care about. So I find myself lately really thinking about the whole picture. How do you organize? Because I have to work on work-life balance myself, and I have to do a better job of showing them what that looks like when you set down and when you're not thinking about it. So I think that as I work on that for me, it's important for me to try to help the kids understand too, like, hey, here's how you, because different generations have different ideas about work and about how much time you're spending on certain things. And I want to be respectful of what these kids value. Some really good advice that I read once was to just be a reporter, be a journalist when you're talking to younger people, especially when they're in a totally different generation than you. When I first started teaching, I was teaching kids that were pretty close to my age. Now I'm working with kids that are pretty far removed. They're at half my age. So their whole worldview is different, and what they think about winning and losing and work ethic and all these things is different. So I have to learn and then try to help prepare them for what the realities are, and what they're going to wind up facing, and still make it be, you know, okay for them to approach it kind of in their own way, their generation's way, their individual way.
Wow, that's really good. I was talking with a parent at a golf camp here recently, and he was retired military. So he was now kind of taking his kid around to tournaments, to camps, to whatever. And he and I were talking about this generation of kids. By the way, you're just, they're half your age. They're a fifth my age. So they're really young. And he and I were talking about, it's very easy to get trapped up in the, you know, kids are changed, kids are different, whatever. They're not. Kids are the same. It's their influences that have changed. And so all I'm trying to do as a 63-year-old golf coach is be a great influence on that 19-year-old college golfer. And I know you being in your, you couldn't be more than, what are you,
31.
31. Yeah. I thought you were 30, but 31. Yeah. So these kids are 14, 15, 16, 17. You remember what it was like to be, but it's a different generation. You've got to help them through that path. And I have to do the same. So I love the fact that you and I both see hope in the next generation of kids. And just because they're different than your generation doesn't mean they're worse. It's they're just different, and they've had different influences. How have you handled being in a different generation with that? I mean, you just explained kind of some of the things you do, but are you good with that?
Yeah, I am. I think it keeps me young, which I like. I think a small thing that's funny that I've had to monitor is certain phrases that I'll use. So, you know, this summer I said, all right, this one's for all the marbles. And a kid looks at me like, what does that mean?
They don't play marbles anymore. Marbles,
I read it. And I had to explain to them, you know, so there are certain things that I have to update my language and lingo to make sure that they're understanding me. But, you know, to your point, I think these kids are amazing. I think that they're smarter than certainly than what I was. I think that with what they go through in school and academically and how much pressure is on them, I think that's at an all-time high, and the stress of picking a college and going. So I have so much empathy for what they're going through. And I think that's honestly what tethers me to kind of how I go about it, is just, understanding, what it is they're going through. So like my my kind of three-step list when I'm communicating with them almost in any moment is first, I have to understand fully. That's where kind of the journalist comes in. Then I have to empathize. So I really try to get in their shoes. So not only understand what's going on, but then empathize with it and try to make a connection to maybe when I was that age or a feeling that I'm feeling now as an adult. Then once I've understood and empathized and they know that I've done that, I now have the microphone to say what I want to say, if anything. Sometimes I find that by the time I've gotten to a place of understanding and empathy, they feel better and I feel better about what's going on and where they are. And so, but then there are times where after all of that, then I can be a little bit more forward and direct and saying, I think that this is kind of the direction that you need to go, or we need to go, or a shift that we need to make, or you need to consider this. But I think where we miss a younger generation is when we just immediately go into, here's what I think. And because I've gone through all this, this is why you got to listen to me. And because they are so smart and they can know pretty quickly, well, no, you're wrong about that. You haven't gone through this. You don't know what it's like. That's a classic. Like, you don't know what it's like, mom, or you don't know what it's like, coach. And so if I can earn their trust through the understanding and the empathy, I think I'm pretty wide open when it comes to giving some advice or trying to motivate within that framework.
So what you just said, I wrote down, by the way, because my podcast is for me too. It's to learn. And I've heard that in another way. It's like before you have a hard conversation with a kid, he's got to know you're in the trenches with him. You believe him, you understand him. So, but you've said it a different way. I'm actually going to use that and encourage other young coaches to do that. So I appreciate you doing that.
Thank you.
You mentioned something else earlier that I didn't want to gloss over because a lot of kids consider it nowadays, especially in the COVID era, especially in the just kind of things that have happened. And that's a gap year. I want you to tell me how you handle it, what you did to make it valuable for you, and why it's a good thing, or could it be a good thing? What is it? Gap years.
So I had a 2-year stretch in there because as a senior, I spent the first semester in Florida, living with some friends so that I could kind of play more and hopefully kind of maybe get it back. You know, there's very much this idea of trying to get back. And so we did that. Nothing really panned out competitively, and then decided on the gap year. And so in the gap year, so, you know, we maybe made that decision sometime in May or so. And so then I had the summer just to kind of train and go about it. And so one of the things that it did for me that I remember for sure, it allowed me to exhale a little bit and know that, okay, I'm not up against the time clock anymore. And then we put a tournament on the schedule. We put it some months away. And I went into a very intense prep for that tournament, working with, you know, swing coach, working with a trainer, just on a pretty deliberate schedule of, okay, you've got all this time now. My parents did a good job of not, you know, guilting me and saying, okay, well, since you're not going to school, you got to do blah, 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 blah. They knew that I'm invested in trying to play as good a golf as I can. So I was in such a bad way in terms of my confidence about my driver. One of the things that I did, I took a notebook and I brought a fresh notebook and I wrote down in it every day about 100 times, I can hit fairways. I can hit fairways. I filled up an entire notebook like that between probably August and then October 10th, which is the day the tournament was. And I went out there and I felt, okay, like you've been working for this. You've been, you know, giving yourself affirmations. You can do this. And I wound up, you know, winning in a playoff.
Really?
Had the offer then, you know, a month later. So my gap year went just about as good as it could have gone, because I won that first one and then was able to just start getting ready for Ball State and wrapping my head around that. But I think the broader conversation now as it relates to college is that college isn't for everybody. Depending on the age that you are and how you've matured and how you've developed, you may still be behind as a 16, 17 year old. And I think one good thing about some of the rules changes is to try to get recruiting at a period where everybody's similarly developed, but still there's no way to kind of make up that gap sometimes if you're a late bloomer, late developer or whatever. So I would encourage all families to be a little bit more open about one, obviously, where they go and the education that they get, because there's a lot of ways to get a good education and be set up well for your life. But then two, if you need a little more time to find out if this is really for them or not, and a gap year makes sense, or even a semester, I think that that's okay to explore, because there's plenty of time to decide, okay, I'm just going to go to school. You're delaying going in the workforce by a year, and I prefer that if we're more sure about kind of the direction. But if you go play and you're not really sure that it's what you want, and then you're getting up at 6 in the morning, and if you're late, you got to do this, and you're playing after that, and you got study tables, and you're like, I'm miserable, but feel like you can't get out of it because you've dedicated so much of your time and your parents have. That's a fast way to have a 4-year experience that's not enriching. And to me, that's heartbreaking, because it has the potential to be incredibly life-changing and enriching. But if it's not for you, you shouldn't be there. And so I think taking the time to have lots of conversations junior year, senior year, if you take a gap year and figure out, is this the right life decision for me? Should I sign this 4-year contract, so to speak, to do this? And for some people, it's no and should be no. And then for some people, it's a definite yes. But I think having those conversations gets you closer.
Oh, really, really good. And I actually have a young man who's going to be taking a gap year, and I'm glad you said that. I'm going to have him listen to this podcast, especially this portion of it, just so he understands, the value of it and what he should be doing during that year. So, before we kind of wind this down, I want to say this. I was very similar to you. I was an assistant golf pro. I was a high school coach, but I was also a junior golf director. So I gave tons and tons of lessons. I don't know how you manage it, because I remember being 23 or 4 and working at Kicking Bird Golf Course in Edmond, Oklahoma. And I was given 40 lessons a week, and I was working in the golf shop 60 hours, and I was whatever. And I've got a something I've never said publicly, but when we were hosting the Oklahoma Open 1983, Gil Morgan, Bob Tway, Doug Toole, Mark Hayes, a bunch of tour players were playing. It was a big event. And I was an assistant pro, and I was pulling out carts onto the line so that people that were going to tee off, could get their cart before they headed to the tee. And I pull out a cart, and all I hear is Mike McGraw or 10-minute call to the first tee, McGraw, somebody, what? And I thought, wait a second, I don't have my golf shoes on. I'm pulling out golf carts. Do you ever find yourself like coming and going, like, what am I doing? There's so much going on. By the way, I did make the cut that week, but
Nice.
I wasn't prepared.
So I'm super lucky to have one, the folks at the golf course are super supportive of what I do in terms of junior golf and how passionate I am about that. And they've made it really easy for me to, balance both. As the years have gone on, I've really made it a point to try to go to tournaments and caddy and be there and see it all. As the numbers have gone up, and if I have 10 kids competing in an event spaced out on all these tee times, I'm maybe only seeing one hole from each person with walk time. But as time has gone on, I've tried to embrace that. That's just how junior golf is. And, these kids, and as they grow and as the families learn how to navigate this, it's a moving target. And as the head coach, with parents operating as assistant coaches, trainers, mental coaches operating as assistant coaches, I have to be the most flexible, to keep everything together and keep it moving the right direction. And I think that that's a part of it that I enjoy. And then have learned to find some peace and reprieve with some of the other stuff, like bringing the carts up at 6 a.m. At the course. Those are times where I can, think and prepare for the day, because I think maybe a few years ago, it was just go, 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 and it was all packed in, and I wasn't doing a good job of rest. And so I think that as time has gone on, I've understood, okay, like, the thing that you're up, because I don't stay up late at night. Our head pro probably does, stays up late at night thinking about the schedule and the next outing, but I don't have to stay up thinking about any of that. So I'm thinking about, can this player hit this chip shot, and how's the club face looking for this player? And so getting away from that and doing other things that still kind of move us in the right direction, those are really helpful for me now. So I've tried to just compartmentalize, know that I'm always going to be, and I've just embraced that about myself. I'm always going to really care about how the kids are doing and what we can maybe do a little bit better. But when I check out from that and I'm doing stuff at the course, or, I'm talking to the ladies before they go off in their league, like those are times for me to just be present there, enjoy that part of the ecosystem that is, being a golf professional, and that be an enriching part of it too.
So I started this podcast out with, I love your gratitude that you have. I think it's great. And a lot of coaches, assistant coaches, head coaches at all levels of college golf listen to this podcast. So I'm sorry, and I know you love what you're doing, but you're going to get some calls. People are going to want you to coach college golf. You would be an amazing college golf coach. You really would be, because you've got the combination of having been a good player. You just got this amazing perspective on life, which I really love, and the way you approach how you train somebody and the perspective you have with their result and the relationship you have with the game. All very good stuff. So I'm sorry, but you're probably going to be getting some calls going forward, Albert.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, listen, I just want you to know this has been an incredible hour for me. Most people would say, well, tell me where did you come up with this? I didn't. It was like we've been connecting for so long, and but I it was great for me, if nothing else, selfishly, to get caught up with you. Like, I remember that little 14-year-old kid that was on that visit, and I was way too young to be on a visit and all of that. But I really, really do appreciate that, and I thank you a lot for coming on the podcast today.
Yeah, I appreciate you. And I wanted to tell you this one thing that I was with a player that I've spent a lot of time with. Her name's Sabrina. She actually just transferred to Ball State and is going to play there. And we were talking, and she's a golf nerd, and she'll make a list in her phone of just like questions to ask me next time we talk. And she asked me a question about your podcast. And she's like, "Oh, do you ever listen to that?" And I was like, "Yeah, Coach McGraw was like the first coach that ever recruited me and I went on a visit with." And I said, "I've thought a few times about reaching out and asking about, being on, and maybe we could have a conversation. I just, haven't." And he's got a lot of people and da 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 da. And she's like, "Well, you should just ask, And she's someone that, as a student, I'm constantly saying something similar to her, where it's like, "I don't know if I can hit this shot," or, "I'm not sure." It's like, "No, you just do it. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? You don't, or it doesn't happen for you." So I thought that that was a cool moment that I had a student giving me advice, and just like, why don't you just ask him?
Well, it's been absolutely my pleasure, and best of luck to Sabrina, by the way. I'm glad she's a loyal listener. This podcast has a small listenership relative to podcasts in the world, right? But it's very loyal, the people that, and so that's why I want to bring quality people on like you. And honestly, I'm not saying that tongue in cheek. You would be an incredible college golf coach. Trust me, you'd be amazing. So thank you very much, Albert, for spending the hour with me. And tell your parents I said hey, if you would.
I will.
And we'll see you on down the road, I'm sure.
All right, good deal. Thanks, Coach.